me start reviewing what we did yesterday. Okay, so yesterday we reviewed the transfer matrix method. As a tool to talk about universality. And so we started with the Hamiltonian of the classical Ising chain. With M sites and periodic boundary conditions. And our goal was to compute the partition function. So again, the sum over all the configurations, the exponential of the Hamiltonian. And we saw that we can write it in this way, like a matrix product with the trace here, where this T1, I write them again because I will use them later. And T2 are the following. Okay. So in this way, we can obtain the partition function and the free energy. But then starting from here, we talked about what is the scaling limit. So the scaling limit consists in embedding our lattice in a real space, and therefore we have the lattice constant. A, and then we want to send A to zero by keeping the macroscopic quantities fixed. So in particular, we have this tau is equal A times L. So now this is a real coordinate. And we have the magnetic field is H over A. And the total size of the system is M times A. So the scaling limit is sending this to zero, keeping this constant. And with this approximation, we saw that by defining psi to the minus 1 as 1 over a, the logarithm of the hyperbolic cotangent of k, then we obtain two things that we use. So one is that the correlation functions in tau, so defined as sigma z tau sigma z 0. And by this, I mean the average using this partition function. So I could put z here. Are approximately e to the minus tau over xi. And I didn't give you the exact one yet, which I will do shortly. But also for large k, we can see from here that psi over a can be approximated by 1 over 2 e to the 2k. Yes. And this is much greater than 1 for large k. So this is the interesting thing that happens in the scaling limit, because As we said, we have spins that are correlated at distances that are much larger than the lattice spacing, and this has the consequences that we saw yesterday that are basically universality, that I will repeat here. So universality is the statement that phi zero, the free energy density, can be written like minus second zero, which is some non-universal constant, minus 1 over L phi f, which is a function, a universal function of L over psi and h tilde L. And this function is, so let me write it because later I want to use it again, is the logarithm of a 2 cosh square root, and then we have 1 over 4 L over psi square plus h tilde L square. Okay, so universality means that if we change the microscopic details of our theory, so we change the Hamiltonian by inserting some other short-range interaction between the spins, phi f will be exactly the same. And if you compute, so you remember that we found an expression, an exact expression for c tau in terms of the sum of the epsilon 1 to the m minus l plus times epsilon 2 to the l prime minus l. So it was yesterday. So if now you apply the scaling limit to that expression, so this is what I forgot to say yesterday. So c tau is again some universal function, which is this one. So it is e to the minus tau over xi, that is the leading term, that is this one, plus e to the minus l minus tau over xi, 1 plus e to the minus l over xi. So you can see that for very large l, for a large system, this is the leading term. But the universal function is this one, and I want to keep it here because later we will compare it with what we find. Okay, so the second objective of having our transfer matrix method was to show what is the classical quantum mapping which is an extremely powerful and conceptually interesting thing. So what we want to show is that if we have a d-dimensional classical statistical mechanical model, this can be mapped to a small d plus one by time, plus one I mean time, quantum model, where d is equal d plus one. Okay, so this is what I want to show. And why I want to do that? Because we can show two things. First, that the quantum theory is the universal theory describing the whole universality class of the classical models. And the second thing is that calculations are easier . So I kept repeating that. So if you remember that C tau there, so let me add it on the blackboard, was derived for H tilde equals zero. And it is very hard to, I mean, it's very long and boring to derive it for H tilde different from zero, but we will see what happens after the mapping. And okay, then other than these two results, once you have a mapping that compares classical and quantum models, all these things are always very useful because sometimes when you are using the quantum, when you are studying some new quantum model, maybe you have some classical results that you can use, or vice versa, and these things happen all the time. And even when, so not everything translates exactly. I will show what translates and what does not. But even when it is not exact, it is a good guideline to try to understand what is going on. Okay, so how does this classical quantum mapping work? So the idea is the following. Let me see. So we have our classicalizing chain. And so these spins are described by coordinate that is tau. And then we have the L spin here, the L plus one spin here, and in between there is A, right? Okay, so now we know from the transfer matrix method that we can compute the partition function by seeing how the influence of L is transferred to L plus 1. And this is exactly what the transfer matrix does. And this is T1, T2. Okay. And now what we would like to do is to establish an equivalence between, so let me put some strange symbol here, because then I will show in what sense it's an equivalence. So let me put like this, between this transfer and evolution in time. So now imagine that tau is a time coordinate. Then between L and L plus 1, this is I'm evolving for a time of length A. And I want this to be quantum evolution. Okay. So I would like to find out if there is some quantum Hamiltonian such that this matrix can be written like e to the minus a hq. Okay, so this is quantum evolution. But we immediately notice two things. So first of all, this is the quantum evolution of what type of system? What system am I evolving in time if this is the next time step of this? No, so no, it's not zero temperature. Huh? Sorry? Zero dimension. Oh, sorry, I didn't understand. Absolutely, zero dimension problem. So because this has become time, we are evolving one spin, one quantum spin in time. So the one-dimensional problem has become 0 plus 1. So this is the first thing that we notice. The second thing that we notice, so I said, oh, this is quantum evolution, but something is off, right? What is the unitary operator associated to quantum evolution by certain Hamiltonian HQ? What is off here? So that A is a real number, that there should be an I here, right? So this means that this is evolution in imaginary time. So evolution in imaginary time for many things is the same thing, but not for everything. So when we do analytic continuations of some quantities between the on the complex plane, not everything goes always smooth, so we have to be careful. Okay, right. So the relationship is that first of all, I can interpret the transfer matrix, that's something that belongs to the classical model, as time evolution in the quantum model. The second thing is that I will be able to write my partition function that was trace of e to the minus h, and this h is the classical system. Through the mapping, this will become the trace of e to the minus hq over a certain temperature T. Okay? So we can compute this partition function and correlation functions and everything, and in a way that is much easier, by computing this partition function. That is the partition function of, in this case, for instance, of a zero-dimensional system. And now there is a T here that has appeared, okay? That before we didn't have. And the reason why before we didn't have this T is that in order to make this equivalence, as I will show you in a second, we need somehow to show how this little a scales with the size of the system, right? We are doing this scaling limit. I'll show you in a second that taking care the fact that we have a little a here and that is small is introducing a length scale that will become the temperature. Okay? In fact, we already know what it is. It's the fact that the total length of the chain is equal to the number of sites m times a. So if I want to establish this, I will show you that I need to send a to 0, which requires that I have to send m to infinity in a way that I keep this constant. But I can do this in so many ways, right? I can do this. I can send m to infinity in order to have any constant L that I want. And this L will fix the temperature here. Okay, so I'm gonna do it right now. So how do we do that? Okay, so basically this is what I want to do, right? So what was this Z? Is, we just said it, it's tai 1, tai 2 to the M with periodic boundary conditions. Okay. So tai 1, T1 was Ek minus K, E minus K, Ek. Okay, so far so good. So let me write this in this way. E to the 2K, no, sorry, E to the K, the identity plus E to the minus 2K sigma X. By sigma X, I just mean this matrix. Okay, so this is an identity. But now I want to use this. Okay? So I want to use the fact that I can express e to the 2k in terms of the correlation function, of the correlation length and of a little a. So when k is large, this becomes e to the k, the identity plus a over 2 psi sigma x. Okay? And again, by expanding the exponential, so if you expand the exponential, you'll see that this is equal to what I'm writing is equal to this, and it is a times minus e0 plus 1 over 2 psi sigma x. So there is just a little algebra to go from here to there. Okay, so this is just a convenient way of expressing T1. And T2 is easier. I don't have to do anything because T2 was just, it was this, right? It was E to H sigma Z, which now I can write like E to the A H tilde sigma Z. So basically, what I wanted to do is write both T1 as an the exponential of A times an operator 1 and T2 e to the A another operator 2. Why I want to do this? Because in here I have T1, T2. Okay. And this is equal, therefore, e to the a o1 times e to the a o2. And what every time you have to, you are dealing with operators, you would so much love to do this. And all the trouble with quantum mechanics is that you can't. Because in general, O1 and O2 do not commute, right? However, what error am I making if I'm doing this? So can you evaluate how different is this operator from the real one? Yep. Yeah. I don't need the whole formula. I mean, I'm expanding in A. This is what you have to see. So this order, whatever is the rest, is order of A square. Okay. So even if you don't remember the formula, but there is A square, right? Okay. So this is the crucial point. Because in the scaling limit, again, A is small. It's very small. So I can, it's a good approximation to write T1, T2 as the exponential of A times O1 plus O2. And so let's write what it is, O1 plus O2 is equal to minus E0 plus 1 over 2 psi sigma x, right? And plus H tilde sigma z. And now if I define this to be minus HQ, you see that T1, T2 is approximately equal to e to the minus a hq. Okay? So this is the first result. And we can have fun and decide that we call 1 over psi delta. But now you see, so before I go ahead, this is definitely the quantum Hamiltonian of a single spin. So I have a single spin in an external magnetic field, depending on what basis. So we can say it's this spin in an external magnetic field along X or vice versa. Okay, so what is the partition function? So this is the first thing I promised. The transfer matrix is the evolution for a time, imaginary time A, of a single quantum spin system described by this Hamiltonian. And then, okay, what is the partition function? Is T1, T2 to the M. Okay, but this is just the trace of e to the minus am hq. I'm just taking this power. And this is the trace. So what is am? Okay, so I have evolved for the total time that is the length of all my chain L, of my ring, right? Because I have periodic boundary conditions. Okay, but now I can define this to be an inverse temperature. And here we have the trace of e to the minus hq over t. Okay, so this is the promised result, the partition function, the same partition function of my classical model, is the partition function of the quantum model at a T that is not the original temperature. Remember that the classical temperature was incorporated in H and K, but it is this T that is basically given by the length of the system. Okay, so we've mapped to the 1D. Okay, so what can we do with it? Okay. Now, first of all, we would like to diagonalize this Hamiltonian, which is very easy, right? Because it's a 2 by 2 Hamiltonian. It's the Hamiltonian of a single spin. So we get eigen energies that are I0 plus minus delta over 2 squared plus h tilde squared, okay? Which means that immediately, what is my free energy is minus t log z. So the free energy for this system, and this is the free energy is also the free energy density because this is a system of single particles, so we don't have any number of particles to rescale. And this is E0. Okay, so if you plug the expression for the partition function, that is just the sum of these eigenvalues, then you have minus T log, you do the algebra, and you have this. And here you have T. Now, if you notice that T is 1 over L, you see that this is exactly phi F. It's up there. So the free energy density of this single spin is the universal function. So this means that the single spin, quantum spin, is the universal theory for all the classical Ising chains with short range interactions. Yep.
Two questions regarding the link. So the first one is we say we map to a T plus 1 quantum model, but the way you phrase it in the end is you then have a partition function. So is there time then? Because it's just like the in original classical model, we don't have time because we're looking at the equilibrium partition function. We're looking at the partition function of the.
Yeah. So you want to know why we say plus one? It's so the reason is that the quantum Hamiltonian defines a time coordinate, whereas a classical energy in statistical, if I give you these classical H's, I call them Hamiltonians, but they actually do not define equations of motions. You need a separate equation of motions to describe the dynamics of this. So in statistical mechanics, there, you know, it's really static. It's only equilibrium properties. But I have given you a full-fledged quantum Hamiltonian, so that defines a time evolution because it is the generator of time evolution when you exponentiate it. So in this sense, the small d plus one. Yep. Yeah.
So it doesn't work for if you would have non-commuting operators?
Well, it wouldn't be a classical quantum mapping. Okay. It would be some other mapping if you can establish, but it would be already a quantum mechanics. So in the following, I will do the inverse mapping. So I will start with the quantum model that has, therefore, non-commuting operators, and I will land onto a classical model that is made of commuting operators. Of course, you can make quantum mappings, like the one, like the duality that I showed you yesterday. But so that is not a classical quantum mapping because of this. Okay, so this is the theory. And now, finally, I want to show you that now we can much more easily compute the full correlation functions for any H. Okay, so let's define first of all CQ. Okay, so some correlation function defined for the quantum model for tau one, tau two. So this is a time ordered correlation function. So this means that tau 1 is greater than tau 2. And if not, you will have to exchange tau 1 and tau 2 in the expression. And I define it as, OK. So I want to take, I don't need to justify a definition, but I want to talk about the average value of sigma z at different times. So the different time correlations in average. So I will do 1 over z, the trace of e to the minus hq over t, sigma z tau 1, sigma z tau 2. So what does it mean? If I consider the value of sigma z at time tau 1, and then of the same spin at time tau 2, in average, how much these two values are correlated? Okay. So the question you have to ask me is, and also you have to answer, but what is this? What is sigma z of tau 1? So also this goes in the direction of your why there is time. Yeah, this is very good. So this is the time evolution in the Heisenberg picture. Therefore, is and it's always in imaginary time because our time is imaginary. Okay. So this is what I want to compute. And so if you are very careful in interpreting how, so we saw how the mapping transforms the transfer matrix and therefore the Z to this thing, right? To the this time evolution. If you do carefully, so you inspect closely the same thing, so with some care, but it's just by inspection, you will find out that this quantity that I have defined in this way is equal to this, to the limit for A going to zero of sigma Z at the position tau 1, sigma Z at the position tau 2. And you remember that sigma Z at the position tau just meant sigma Z L, where tau is equal LA. This is in the classical mode, where this average is taken with the H, and by H I'm always meaning the classical Hamiltonian. So this is the classical average. So this quantity that I've defined independently turns out to be the correlation functions that we wanted. Okay, so if we are able to compute this, we are done. Okay, but now this is not too difficult because this is just an average on a 2x2 system. And so let's see how to evaluate it. So we can actually evaluate this. It's not too difficult for every temperature, but let's go to zero temperature, okay? So let's do T equals zero. So we evaluate the zero temperature correlation functions, which means we are looking at the infinite chain. This is good enough because in fact, when we want to know the correlation functions of the classical model, you know, we really are interested just in the thermodynamic limit. This expression contains more because in the quantum system, we can have these correlation functions at every temperature and there is no scale because it's a fixed number of spins. Okay, so let's see. Okay, so CQ or tau 1, tau 2. So why this is a convenient thing to do? Because why this expression becomes much easier when t goes to zero? So because this term is much, instead of being, I mean, it's still not a big deal because this is an exponential of a two by two matrix, which is not a big deal. But if t is equal to zero, you are just in the ground state. So you only want to know what happens to these objects in the ground state and not in the full mixed state at finite temperature. So I can introduce a complete set of eigenvectors, right? I introduce it in here. And I take the trace, and so this becomes the sum over n of 0 my sigma z n square, and then I have e to the minus en minus c0 and tau 1 minus tau 2. And there is the absolute value because this is the time ordered. So here I did something that doesn't seem very smart because I have only two eigenstates in my system, right? So this n actually goes for only from, you know, there is the ground state and then there's the other state. The reason why I'm writing it like this and such that does like this in the book is that we are deriving this expression for the very simple model, but this is much more general. So in higher dimensional systems, now you will have something that has many, many states, but you still have something like this. And in general, you will see that the long time correlation functions, so when tau 1 is much greater than tau 2, are basically dominated by the greatest of these differences. Sorry, by the smallest of these differences, right? Because this thing is decaying exponentially. It's not oscillating, right? Because there is no imaginary time. So I can replace this with just E1 minus E0, the first excited state. So here there is no approximation because we only have the first excited state. But more in general, you can do that. And so this shows that this correlation functions decay like e to the minus pi 1 minus pi 2 over some psi, where psi is defined like E1 minus E0, 1 over E1 minus E0, which is 1 over delta, the gap. So this is another way of seeing how we get this exponential decay. OK, so now we can evaluate directly this expression. But now this is just algebra, right? Because I have to sum over these two states. And I can do it for every value of h tilde. I have my eigenvalues and my eigenvectors of my matrix. And so you just do the math. This is really, it's a cumbersome expression that is, so let me copy it from the Sachdev book, is something like 4y3 over 2. Z plus y square z cosh square root of z 1 minus, so the cosh of all of this y1, and here you have cosh, where z is defined like this variable y2 squared plus 4y3 squared. And what are these y1, y2, y3? So this is the expression for phi sigma y1, y2, y3, where by y1 we meant, okay, so y1, you remember it was tau, and tau is tau 1 minus tau 2, right? Over L, y2 is delta over t, which is also a way of saying L over psi. Remember the ways of combining these ratios. And y3 is L h tilde, which is also h tilde over t. And you can easily check that when y3 is equal 0, means so we get the expression for h tilde is equal 0, which will coincide with the psi tau, that c tau that is there. So you can verify this. OK, so we saw that the quantum classical mapping also gave us this result. So again, you obtain that by just computing that expression It is easy because we have diagonalized the Hamiltonian. It's a 2x2 matrix. The rest is just algebra. Okay. So this was interesting from the point of view, from first of all, the conceptual point of view, and it's useful to compute things that actually we need them for the classical case. Because for the quantum case, we don't care very much about one spin in a magnetic field. I mean, in itself, it's not interesting. It's interesting because it's the universal theory for the classical case. Okay, yeah?
I'm just wondering, so this seems to only work for, so does any classical system have the transfer matrix?
Yeah. So all classical systems have a transfer matrix description. The point is that sometimes, so you can formulate it, but doesn't mean that you are able to carry over all the calculations. So the reason is that, in the 1D classicalizing, we can do everything because this T1 and T2 are 2x2. But we'll see in a second. Now I go to higher dimensions, that they become 2 to the m times 2 to the m, where m is the size of the system. So it's not always, so it's something that you can establish to do the mapping, but it doesn't give you directly some result. In fact, so we'll see. So what I want to do now is to do the mapping between. So now we do it in the inverse way, but between two different systems. So we want the D equal 1 quantum system, which is what we called so far HI. Right? So let me write it again. So I was using J and G, right? For the So between this and the D equal 2, because 2 is equal to 1 plus 1, classicalizing. So now we want to do the reverse. So we want to write the partition function at some temperature of the quantum model and see that it becomes the partition function at other temperatures of the classical model. So let's try to see what is really going on, okay? Because now, let me start horizontally. So our starting system that is labeled by some x is a quantumizing chain, okay? So this is a quantumizing chain, and I'm not doing anything special to this spacing, okay? This is still labeled by I plus 1, etc. So now I want to do the time evolution of this. So I want to evolve in a small imaginary time that is a. So after a small time a, I will have another quantum spin, right? It has evolved. So, and there will be some couplings here that have evolved all these spins. So now you see that this is a apart. So if I keep going, after 2a, I have another rising spin and so on. So at the time tau is equal LA, I have some other one. Okay. So the time evolution is going in this way. And here we have our genuine special couplings in the quantum system that before we didn't have it because it was zero dimensional. It was one single spin. It was not coupled to anything else. Now we have an array of spins where there is no external magnetic field. So this is there is no H tilde sigma z. This is my spin, but I have a coupling between nearest neighbors. Okay. So what is our partition function for the quantum model? Is the trace of x minus hi over t. Right? This is my Hamiltonian, my quantum Hamiltonian. And I write the partition function at a certain temperature t. Okay, but now let's remember that for us, t, 1 over t is a length, is in fact the total length of the system, which is m times a. Okay, so now do I have to put m here? So here I have m sides, right? But now I'm counting how many steps in time evolution I do. This L is the length in imaginary time. So the total number of steps that I do doesn't need to be the length of the chain. These are two completely different things. So let me put m tau. So you see that there is a fundamental anisotropy between what happens in this direction and what happens in this direction. They're really independent. So we don't know if we can establish the mapping for every value of all the coupling constants that I will have. So I am anticipating the fact that when we land in the Ising model, we don't necessarily land in the Ising model with the same couplings in the y direction and the x direction. Because somehow we are constrained by the fact that now in this direction, we have to make the scaling limit. OK. OK, so and how, of course, the time evolution for a step A is e to the minus a hi, right? So let's remember that the relevant limit, again, it will be a goes to 0 and m goes to infinity, m tau goes to infinity, such that 1 over t equal l is equal ma to be a constant. So this is the limit that eventually we need to take. OK, so what I want to do, I want to take this. So I want to do the inverse thing, right? Before we took the transfer matrix and we tried to construct a quantum, we tried to write it like the evolution generated by a quantum Hamiltonian. Now we are starting from this evolution that is here. And we would like to write it as a some T1, T2. Okay? We already know that in order to do this, unless all the terms in HI commute, there will be some error of order A square, which we can neglect because we are doing the scaling limit. And of course, because it's a quantum system, these terms do not commute. Okay, so we do need to do that. Okay, so how do we do this? Okay, so what are my T1 and T2? So T1 Well, so we see it by inspection by looking at our matrix, right? T1 will be exp of jg, and then I have to put an a, right? Because I want T1, T2 to be e to the minus a. So jga and T2 is exp ja, and here I have the Ising coupling. Okay. So what I want to do is again, so I'm saying that T1 times T2 is e to the minus a hi with an error of order a square. You can see it by inspection. Okay? But then we want to be able to actually compute something that looks like the trace of T1, T2 to the m tau, right? So we need to do some calculations now. So we need to find a basis in which we can compute this matrix product and take the trace. So the most convenient basis for these matrices is the so let's do the calculation. Let's work in the so-called Z basis. So the Z basis is made of those eigenvectors. So such that uses this notation mi that are simultaneous eigenvectors of all the sigma zi. Okay? So that's why it's called the Z basis. In simple words, these are all those products that are strings of ones or minus ones. Because, of course, these are simultaneous eigenvectors of all the sigma z. Sometimes this is called computational basis, because this is just a string of one or minus one or zero or ones, depending how you define things. Okay, so the exponential of this thing, JGA sum, sorry, the first term, the Ising term, is easy, right? On each of, because this matrix contains just sigma z, right? So it's a diagonal in the basis of the eigenvectors of sigma z. So this is just exp of ja, the sum of mi, mi plus 1. And doesn't change the vector. OK, so this was trivial. Now I need to see what happens, what are the matrix elements of a T2, right? So the matrix elements of T2, okay, so now I have to be careful. Sorry, this is T2 of T1. So first, let me write what is that I want to compute. Why I'm computing this matrix element. So I want to compute Z, right? So Z is T1, T2 to the M tau. Okay, and because this is many products of all these T1, T2 that have an exponential form, now I can write it like this, the sum over products of T1, T2 in different spin configurations, right? I take some spin configuration, mi at a certain slice that is labeled by L, and I'm transferring with the transfer matrix at the imagery time L plus one. Okay, so my spin configurations are labeled by I in this direction and L in this direction. So I want to compute this object, tie one, tie two, M, I, L plus one. It's just the value of T1, T2 between the spin I on the slice L and the spin I at the spin L plus 1. And then I want to sum over all the spins and all the slices. So I have to sum over all the spin configuration, so the M for every row and column. And wait a second, we are doing this. This is the product on all the m tau steps in the y in the tau direction. So this is the product of all of them. So it goes L goes from 1 to m tau. So if you remember what we did for the 1D, disregard I. Imagine that I is fixed. And we had exactly the same expression. But now we also have this, our quantum system is also running in the I direction. So we have this thing. How many spin configurations do we have here? So they are 2 to the m times 2 to the m tau. Because there are 2 to the m spin configurations on the x direction, 2 to the m tau in the tau direction. So this is a huge sum. Okay, and now we want to insert. Okay, so tau 2, we know how it acts because it gives me this eigenvalue and leaves everything else intact. So now I have to see what happens to T1. That's why I was computing T1 and T2. And T1, okay, so what are the matrix element of T1? So pretty much I have to do this. Okay, so now let me write it. Let me not hurry up. So I have to, let me write it. M-I-L T1 M-I-L plus 1. So, but what is T1? Is the exponential of this sum. But now these all commute. They're all sigma x's. So it's the product of all those exponentials. Right? And this product goes in the I direction, right? Because the sum is in the I direction. So it's the product for every I that goes from 1 to m of the thing that is e to the j g a sigma x I. M I L plus one. Now the interesting thing is that even if T1 is a matrix that is huge, right? Because it's 2 to the m times 2 to the m. But we wrote it like the product of matrices that are 2 by 2. Each of these objects can be easily computed. So you can just do it directly. And the what you get is, so this is the part with G. Yeah, so what you get here is something that has this form. You get some sum over I and L. There is some coefficient that is the result that comes from here. And then you have MIL, MIL plus 1. So when you put the things together, when you put this term with the first term that was this one, and you normalize the things correctly, so there is a little bit of algebra to do. But what you notice is that you have the sum over two terms, one that is some coefficient times mi, mi plus 1. And the other one is another coefficient, the sum over mi, l, mi, l plus 1. So here we have these numbers that can be plus or minus 1 because they are the eigenvalues of sigma z, that for a fixed l, they are coupled ii plus 1. And here we fix I and we vary L, we couple them in L, L plus 1. So the final result is that the partition function is the sum over all these spin configurations of the exponential of this sum. I L J A M I L M I plus 1, right? L plus certain coefficient B that I will define later, M I L M I L plus 1. But what is this? This is minus the Hamiltonian of the classicalizing model in two dimensions with those non-isotropic couplings, where B is defined by e to the minus 2b tan h j g a. And actually, you see that if A is small, this needs to be large. So this anisotropy is essential. It's not something that you can get rid of. So all the details of this final part of the calculation, so basically how to compute B, are on the such def book. So don't worry about it. The important thing is that you see how the method works, and that, in fact, we could establish the mapping to a classical model. Okay, so with this result, we are not able to know much because I have just written the partition function this way. It doesn't mean that I am able to compute it, right? Because now I just know, oh, it's the one of the 2D Ising model, but who gives me the one of the 2D Ising model? So I don't know if you've already done the first tutorial, which you have done perturbation theory. So you have seen that for the quantumizing chain, you can compute already several things in perturbation theory. But now we have reached the moment when we don't want to approximate methods anymore. We want to give the full solution of the 1D quantumizing chain that basically, thanks to this mapping, also gives us the full solution of the classical 2D Ising model. And this is the topic of tomorrow. Questions? So, can you speak louder, please? Yes, but no surprise, and nobody can do that. But if you are able to solve the quantum 2D Ising model, you do win the Nobel Prize. This is a. it's NP by brute force. Right? So all these complexity classes are, if you have an algorithm, right, by brute force. But if I had a solution, right? I had a solution because I guess it, or because I'm, or because we are on Sager and you know how, you know. Then every analytical solution has complexity order one. So there is a huge debate about what are the theoretical abstractions to that, and I am. I know that lately many string theorists are working to that as well, but I don't think that the final word about whether it's really impossible or not has been said. So I don't want to take any stance. Well, there is a lot of numerical progress, even if it's very complex. But people have we have nice Monte Carlo results, and yeah, we know more or less how the gap goes. We have critical exponents, but pretty much everything is numerical. And I think that there is some progress about what are the excitations of this model, of the 3D classicalizing of or of the 2+1. We know how the gap scales at the quantum critical point. So we know it numerically. I mean, it's good enough for the applications, but no, we don't.
But there has been no progress in trying to find an analytical solution. I mean, they have tried, but there has been no progress. As in, like, we haven't found anything concrete yet.
Yeah, so progress is some very vague word. I mean, so if I say no, everyone who has spent their life, you know, doing progress on that will eat me. So I'm sure that for the practitioners in the field, there is some progress. But none that I'm able to use. So when I do use these things for. Maybe I will mention something about topological phase transitions in the last lecture, and many results have been obtained by mapping onto the 2D quantumizing model, but I always had to borrow numerical results from the 3Dizing model or to do. Numerical results on the 2D quantum model. I was never able to. At some point, I needed these numerics. Yeah.